listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special and newly released at 8 a.m. Mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips. He is Andrew Page. And I'm not going to ask him what strawman.com is. I don't even care what strawman.com is. What's strawman.com, Andrew?
I was going to say, really? That'd be a first. Go to the website and check it out. You've given the address.
Oh, look out. I like it. Yeah, strawman.com.
Yeah. I could describe it or you could find it yourself.
And of course, I have to tell you that fool.com.au is who I work for, and he doesn't get all the free plugs, where we give investment advice and stock recommendations. Mate, we got a massive mailbag. I think it's our second week back from holidays, and the mailbag is full and overflowing. Let's try and get through some questions. Let's cover some stuff off. Let's get straight into it. Mate, Steve says, hi, Scott and Ram. Thanks for your level-headed approach to all things business and investing. My question is this. I have pages of reasonings and spreadsheets filled with numbers that show what I believe the future holds for the businesses I own. That's a very good start, Steve. However, whenever I pick up a quarterly or annual report, I find myself searching for confirmation of my thesis. Do you have any techniques that can help overcome this need for confirmation bias? As an example, I have started looking for analyst reports, on the companies I own to see how others view their futures, but these are hard to come by for free. I've read the little book of behavioral investing, which is spectacular, which is fascinating, says Steve, is the catalyst for this whole internal battle. Thanks for any help you can offer. That's from Steve. I'll just throw a personal anecdote, Andrew. There was a broker note out not too long ago. It was in the public domain. And someone shared it internally at the Motley Fool. Hey, there's this issue report if you ever want to look. And we all individually went through a subtle look for, I wonder if they like the companies I like. Oh, that's good. That's good. They like that one. Which is exactly the confirmation bias that Steve's talking about. And even though you know better, I've used this example before, mate. I used to work in the food industry. And the impulse purchase is one of the king, you put something in front of people, you put Kit Kats at the checkout, or you put, whatever it is in front of people, the shapes on the end of the aisle. They're trying to get you to impulsively pick it up and go, oh, okay, I'll grab that. And I do it, I look at it and go, I know you just want me to buy the kicker. I know that's why it's here. I'm going to do it. Okay, but I know what you're doing to me. It's like, I can't avoid it even though I want to avoid it. It's that thing of, trying not to do it even when you know what's going on is really, really, really hard because we're just human. Yeah. What do you do, mate? How do you avoid? We all want to see that our theses are playing out, right? The problem is that becomes a bit of a, can I find evidence that maybe I might possibly be right if I kind of tilt it and squint and imagine that maybe a couple of words are different, maybe I can almost see that things are working out. How do you separate genuine confirmation of, hey, I think I'm right, from I'll take anything and just call it confirmation bias? I'll just, whatever's close enough is good enough, I'll take it.
I love this question from Steve, and I'd be lying if I said, oh, well, this is how I avoid it, because I don't avoid it, because I do exactly the same, and I know what I'm doing. So it's really
That's the
hard.
Worst part. I know I'm doing it. I can't help myself doing it. I still feel better that it's there. It's like, oh, damn it.
Oh, it's, gosh, we're so pathetic. Our monkey brains, there's a lot to answer for. I love the quote. This is like, the tragedy of humanity is that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike powers. Isn't that nice?
That's a great line.
I'm not going to know who said that, but
not easy to memorize either. Well done.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot because you could go back in a time machine 10,000 years and pluck someone out. Middle of Africa, and they're exactly like us, every single physiological way.
Yes.
But now that we also have the capacity to like go to Pluto and split the atom and do all these other
and invest, right? That's the fundamental problem. Our brains are not like, you literally need to overcome evolution to invest well. It is literally that stark. And I don't mean that in any sort of I haven't accomplished it, you haven't accomplished it, but to the extent to which you can, I think pretty much outright determines your chance of success.
Oh, it's such a huge thing. I was trying to explain to my little boy the other day who just, like any kid loves lollies. Like, again, 10,000 years ago, you're wandering through the jungle and you come across a bush full of berries. What do? You gorge yourself.
Of course you do.
You put as much – I don't know when I'm going to eat again. It is entirely sensible thing to do, to eat as – no one – in that era was going, maybe I should watch my weight or something like that. You just go for it. And your brain says, oh, this has got sugar in it. This is fantastic. Do it. It's the same with investing.
And that sugar, by the way, the greed and fear. Our grandparents didn't have that much sugar. Like, this is such a new thing. Like, it's, Oh, yeah. It's impossible to you can't overcome the impulse. All you can do is rationally set up some boundaries to try and stop yourself.
So look at the pokey industry, right? So those machines just they're doing all the same kind of tricks, and these days when it comes to the share market, we've got all these apps. They're all doing the same thing. They're all you are incentivized in every way, shape, or form to trade, to act, to do something.
Oh.
Because there is someone out there who's figured all this out, knows that even if people, and this is the greatest trick ever pulled. We know what we're doing, and you know what we're doing to you, and you're still going to do it, right? So anyway, what do? I think for me, the solution or the remedy has always been to keep an investment diary.
Yeah.
And I just think when I'm going to buy something, I write out why I'm buying it. Mm. And I also, during that process, I try to write out what would constitute a break of the thesis.
Yeah.
Will I stick to it?
That's what I was going to say, because that's the hard part, right? The rationale of why you did something is almost easier than the ability to just contort reality to either fit or not fit what we want it to be, right? That's the confirmation bias, Steve. It's not like I bought it for this reason. Like, that's fine. I'm still holding because I think I can possibly squint and see some sort of evidence that I'm right, because I need to be right, because that's just, again, such a human emotion of like, I'd rather mislead myself. Well, it's easy to fool people and convince them they've been fooled.
Yeah.
Right? That's the horrible truth.
So it's not a foolproof approach, but it does help ground me, you know, and I like anyone, you can kind of do mental gymnastics to sort of say, yeah, I know I said that then, but what I didn't realize at the time was, it does help though, because otherwise, I mean, without that, I'm less likely to have a lot of these things front of mind.
Yeah.
So, here's a plug. So with Strawman, and I'll say this because it's free, right? So if you want to create a free account, get on there and you can just, for any company, dial it up, put in what you think is a fair price, and then create we call them straws. They're like tweets, you know? So this is the bull case. This is the risks. This is when I'd sell. As a free user, that's sort of only you can see that, but great, right?
Okay,
now you've got an online journal that you can use that will help keep you honest. Try and help keep you honest for all that kind of stuff. It's not a perfect answer, but it's the best answer I have. And if you don't use that, just use a pen and paper, but just journal it and it does help, I think.
I like it, mate. I have no better answers either to Steve's point and your point, mate. It's you can't overcome it. A couple of things, I think. The first thing I'll say is you probably... It's why, to your point about the diary, but even before the diary, it's why the research when you make the purchase is so important. Because if you choose well, it kind of makes the other stuff less important or less relevant. And that sounds obvious. So here's the thing. We said on Friday, I talked about the fact that you can focus on all the little things, but you can get a couple of big things right? Do you want to be right or do you want to make money? And so my investing has been really simply distilled down to a few things that if I get roughly right more often than not, I'll do okay. Knowing that... There, and you made it, I think, about Howard Marks' 2x2 box, right? Is it knowable and is it important? If it's knowable and important, you better bloody know it. If it's knowable and unimportant, don't bother. If it's super important but unknowable, well, then don't waste your time. So it's kind of, is it knowable? Is it important? The stuff that's in the unknowable and important is just, of course it's important, but it's unknowable. But it's a complete waste of time, right? You are literally, running into a brick wall over and over again. And so for me, it's like if I get the purchase roughly right, if I focus on quality, I focus on the growth potential, I focus on the things that make for a good business more often than not. I'm still going to be wrong sometimes, but if I get the research right and keep buying those businesses that meet that criteria as often as I can or I want to, for me, that's actually kind of part of the overcoming it. It's just like get the decision right up front. Because I said before, if you're squibbling about valuation and then you're saying, well, okay, maybe I'll sell a bit of this, or maybe it's a little bit overvalued, or maybe it's this, you've got to be right about that. Then you've got to be right about whatever else you replace it with. And if you've done the work in the first place to get a really high quality company, you own it. It's like, well, you'd part with it really slowly, right? So for me, I hope most of the, and this, everyone's different. You run your portfolio slightly differently. But for me, I'm hoping most of the companies I own now, I'll still own in 25 years. And some of them will be worth less than I bought them for today. Will I sell them? Maybe. I've sold a couple recently. Eventually sold Gage, Good Drinks Australia, which I laughed about previously. But most stuff I keep is like, well, I'm just going to keep it because the buying for me, if I get that right, is more important than trying to quibble over is there you know, am I suffering confirmation bias on whether it's succeeding or not? So I'm just going to buy it. Yeah. And I buy something else, and buy something else, or buy the same thing over and over again. And then eventually, hopefully, if I'm right more often than not, it's the buying that will save me, not what happens next.
Just to double down on that, I know former colleague of ours, Joe Mager, who ran the fund at the Motley Fool. I got another fund.
Two name checks in two podcasts.
Yeah. Oh, credit where it's due. I mean, Joe got a lot of things right. And he talked a lot about process.
Yeah.
And focus on the process. Trust the process. And I think a lot of new investors go wrong, they think if I've got a good process, it leads to good outcomes all the time. Yeah. But it doesn't. I think maybe not the best analogy, but a good analogy. If you ever watched like 21 or any of those sort of card counting movies, so they, all these people who beat the casino, and they did it because they had a really good process. Now that doesn't mean that they won every hand that they played, but when you're counting. Yeah. They'd have terrible swings.
Yeah.
But it's probabilistic, right? So I've got a process. If I'm counting cards and I know that most of the tens have been played, then it just swings things around.
Yeah.
So I just bet more heavily when the odds are in my favor, and I don't bet when the odds are against me. Mm-hmm. And then here's what really will screw with your mind as investing. Let's say that you do have a great process, right?
Yeah.
Undeniably true, and it's a good one. Mm-hmm. You can prosecute that and just make, quote unquote, mistake after mistake after, like, just, you're like, well, I'm doing everything right.
Yeah.
And the market's there slapping you going, nah, you've done it wrong. You've done it wrong. You've done it wrong. And then during those times, you'll go, okay, I need to reinvent myself. I mean, this is where people go wrong, right?
Exactly.
I'm doing something wrong. Now I need to try this strategy. But the secret is, and again, the big caveat here is that you've got a good process, is that you just stick at it. Even when it's not working, because a process is good by definition if it works more often than it doesn't. That doesn't mean that you can't. A perfectly weighted coin, I can flip heads 10 times in a row. It doesn't mean that there's anything dodgy going on. That's just within the realms of probability that can happen. Is it likely? No. Can it happen? Yeah. In fact, three or four times in a row is really not that improbable. So you get people who are particularly, imagine if you just got into investing a year ago. Right? And you've had, okay, I'm doing this. I'm a pretty good run for 6 months. And then everything's just, you've fallen flat on your face. And what happens every single cycle is like, this sucks. The share market's rigged. It's just a bunch of gambling. It sucks. Yeah. It sucks. It sucks. And I get out and I lose or I switch into, now I start playing some other kind of dodgy strategy or, you know, it takes a huge amount of discipline to just keep focusing, not on the individual outcomes, focus on the process.
Yeah, exactly, Matt. And I think that's the right way to end it. Let's move on to another question from this time, another Steve, funnily enough. Not the same Steve, I can tell by the email address, but another Steve. Guys, what a great pod, by the way. Thanks, Steve. Awesome insights while keeping it understandable and genuine. I've heard you talk a lot about dollar cost averaging into the market using ETFs or LICs, listed investment companies, etc. But how do you know when to dollar cost average into an individual stock? If you buy $500 or $1,000 or $10,000 of a stock and the price goes up, do you need to have done a DCF to calculate what its intrinsic value is and whether to accumulate? Or should you leave dollar cost averaging to the ETFs and LICs? I know Scott had mentioned he rarely does a DCF, so how do you know when to buy more? One more question if I can. What are your thoughts on the 110 minus your age rule for shares to cash ratio? Is it a made up number? P.S. I'm 31, been investing since 26 and have really appreciated your insights through the tougher times to stay the course. Regards, Steve. Mate, I'll take first swing at this one and then you can jump in.
Another good question.
So, Steve, I think what I probably would suggest is the dollar cost averaging idea is a general concept, not a specific thing to apply. So in saying that, so I wouldn't dollar cost average into every single stock every single month. That's not necessarily, you can do it that way if you have cheap brokerage or free brokerage. I guess you could do it that if your way if you wanted to, and maybe that'd actually work. But generally speaking, the idea of dollar cost averaging is just to keep investing regularly, no matter where the market is. And that can apply to individual stocks as well as the market. When I say what the market is, I guess I'm saying, generally speaking, if you put $1,000 a month into the market or $500 a month or $10,000 a month or whatever you've got, to use your numbers, that activity is not necessarily about saying, you know, pick which stock you dollar cost average into and when, because that's what dollar cost averaging is. It's just saying keep investing regularly. Put money to work regularly in your best ideas. That is kind of the more general approach in my mind of dollar cost averaging rather than being really specific. Because same as the market itself, right? There are times when the market will be more expensive and less expensive. And we don't do a DCF on the market to work out whether to buy the ETF this month or not. We simply say we're going to always dollar cost average into the ETF. And so sometimes when the market's super high, sometimes it's super low. Take the COVID years, right? Mid-Feb, you buy some. Then mid-March, you buy some. You're buying it, you know, a 40% discount the second month. You know, was the previous month too high? Was the current month too low? We know in hindsight the answer to that question. But more broadly, it was just a question of just invest regularly. Sometimes you buy high, sometimes you buy low. So that's the broad idea. When it comes to me for dollar cost averaging, that's so if I think about the stocks I'm buying, for me, dollar cost averaging is just putting the same amount of money to work every month, or roughly, you know, it depends on what you're saving and stuff. But generally speaking, that's the idea. I just buy my best idea every month. I just say, okay, I've got $1,000, pick a number. What's my best idea right now? And I do that. And that's what I do with the dollar cost average every, not I would say every single month, but regularly enough. I just buy something every time I've got the money in the account. And for me, that's dollar cost averaging. I pick my best idea. It's not always the same stock. Some companies I only ever bought once, never again. Others I bought 5 or 6 times. ETFs I've done the same with. So it does depend. For me, though, the dollar cost averaging is about at a portfolio level, make sure you're adding more cash rather than at a company level. Within that, I would just simply buy my best idea or ideas plural, depending on how you're breaking up your investment at any point in time. What about you, mate?
No, I think it's well said. Yeah, for a general broad-based ETF approach, just pick a number, a period, and just stick with it no matter what. That's easy. That's really easy. Mm-hmm. For a portfolio of where you're picking your individual stocks, I do it exactly the same way. I actually don't have a set schedule. My personal situation is I don't have a salary, so money comes in when it comes in, and so it's just different. When there is money available to invest, I look around. So in answer to Steve's question on intrinsic value, does that play a part? Yeah. And I look at all of the options that I have. What company has the best risk reward opportunity, which one is trading at the most attractive discount to its intrinsic value, and I'll put money there. Maybe it's the same one that I did the last 3 times in a row. Maybe it's a completely new company, but it depends. So I wouldn't just be buying into a company for the sake of it because I said I would do it every month. I mean, maybe this is a company that I like, but geez, it's like, no, it'd just be ridiculous. It's tripled in the last 3 months. Like, I still like it, but it's not much less valuable. it's a much less attractive proposition at this point in time, all else being equal. So, don't overthink it. Wait till you get a bit of money. Look around. What are your opportunities? What's the best one? Just dribble it in. Dribble it in. And overall, that's a pretty good way to approach it.
Agreed. One quick one about the DCF question, just to quickly touch on that, Steve's. I don't do DCFs very often, mate, largely because...
DRP?
No, he's about DCF specifically. So what he's saying is, how do I choose which stock to buy? If I don't do a DCF, how do I pick the right price to buy what stock?
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And he says, I don't do a DCF, so how do I do that calculation, or how do I work out what stock to buy? It's a combination.
I'm getting my acronyms all mixed up.
Yeah, I know. No, it's a combination of a few things, Steve, for me. The first is that it's a bit like, I'm not going to compare myself to Warren Buffett, but Charlie Munger has never seen Buffett do a DCF. I think for me, partly it's kind of become a bit second nature, just the concept behind it. And knowing that you can never be 100% accurate anyway, once you've got the kind of concept of what sort of growth for what sort of time period, you start to get the kind of a second sense. So I would absolutely start with DCFs. I would get every investor to start with DCFs. And then if you love them, keep using them. If you don't love them, you've learnt the idea, you've kind of internalized the concept, then you can kind of let them go a little bit. So that's for me why I don't do it. Not because I hate them, not because I think they're useless, just because I think it's one of those things. Generally speaking, once I have a sense of, I own probably 20 ASX companies, I think, something like that. I have a sense of what price I think they're worth, or generally kind of what I expect their market futures to look like, their business futures to look like. And when I get the chance to do that, if the shares are down meaningfully or the business improve meaningfully, then I kind of just mentally, almost informally adjust my expectations. So a business has done really, really well. Okay, I'll pay more for that. That's great. It's going really well. The price is still reasonable. But particularly from a dollar cost averaging perspective, once I own it, you can kind of then mentally keep track of the combination of the movement in the business quality and momentum and the movement in the price, and then kind of just adjust your thoughts that way. So some companies fall in half and I wouldn't touch them again. Others go up 15%. I'm like, yeah, I still love it, so I'm going to buy some more. So it's kind of one of those, you'd have to recalibrate to some degree. And I'm not suggesting people be reckless with it at all. I just, for me, it's like I know how big the range of outcomes is likely to be. I tend to prefer quality over price, generally speaking. And also long-term growth potential. And if I can get both of those, I'm kind of, the price is the third in order on that for me. You, mate?
Yeah, it's a really important concept to understand. It does lead you into this false confidence, though, because you put so much work into it. You've got your spreadsheet. I've worked out my revenue line, my cost line, this, my margins. I've done this, I've done that. And it just, my thinking is that the more forecasts, or let's call it what it is, guesses I have to make,
exactly,
the more likely I am to be wrong. So these days, I've got this, I'm sure some people will laugh at this, but it works for me. I guess three things. Mm-hmm. What's revenue going to be 5 years out?
Mm.
What's the net margin going to be 5 years out?
Yeah.
And what's a reasonable multiple that the market would pay for a business like this 5 years out? That gives me the share price of what it is in 5 years. Mm. Then I just need to discount it by what return I want. So I think a company will be earning $100 million in 2027. I think that they have a 10% net margin because that's what businesses in that sector do and rah, 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 rah. Mm. Mm. So they'll make $10 million in net profit. Mm. I think they'll probably trade at a 20 times multiple because they seem to be growing pretty well over that period of time. And that's, you know, not far off the average during good times, et cetera, et cetera, yeah, right. et cetera. So now I've got a $200 million company. Mm. So there's, let's say, $100 million shares on issue. You just, the maths is really simple, right? You just, and then I divide it by, let's say I want 10% a year. I divide it by 1.1 for five times in a row. There's my intrintsic value. People will look at that and go, oh, but you haven't factored this in. You haven't factored that in.
Yeah.
But it's a real, what I know when I do that approach is I know the big things, or I know what the big things need to be. Mm. So what kind of growth is this company likely to achieve? If that's wrong, then the whole thing is wrong. If any of these things are wrong, the whole thing is wrong.
Yeah, that's why I'm not too specific about it, because the chance of getting all three right and right to the degree of specificity required is really tough. I'm going to say for me, mate, the other thing is because I'm generally a dollar cost averaging kind of investor, I'm not looking for an absolute number. I'm trying to work out which is the best of them. So it's a relative game for me where I'm just like, okay, well, I'm going to buy something. And plenty of people sit on cash and just accrue cash. I'd rather be caught with my pants up, to use Buffett's phrase. So I look around and go, I've got $500, $1,000 to invest. Which of these is the best idea I've got? Rather, what's the absolute price? So it's almost a relative game of, you know, to your point, based on the current share price, which has got the best future? Rather than, is it worth it $11 or $12 or $5 a share? It's like, well, there's these two ideas. Which of these has the best potential future from the current price? Again, you can do that with a formal DCF, or for me, it's just kind of like, well, you know, this business is good, bad, better, worse than this business. This is my best idea this month, and so that's the one I go with. It's how we run the service at Remotely for Share Advisor, and I've been there for 10 years. It's been around for 10 and a half. We make a recommendation each month. It's just what is the single best idea we've got? You know, that we don't do intrinsic valuations. We don't do at that service, at least. You know, so we just kind of go, okay, well, that's the best idea. That's the single, you know, of all the available options right now, that's the one I want to put my money in. And because I'm dollar cost averaging, by definition, that's the one I go with.
Yeah. So we could talk about it for hours, right?
Could. It's not make any more sense.
Yeah. I guess the important thing is to have thought about some of these.
Yes,
things.
Yes, yes.
You
yes.
know, is
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Again,
you're right, actually.
What? Don't just buy something because of the share price going up. You've heard it at the pub, or whatever. It's just like, what kind of growth? Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with a company that might not grow at all, right? Yeah. At the price, right? But is this Woolies? Do I think it's like a 3-5% growth, or is this a new tech company which could be 20% growth? Mm. Is it the kind of company that operates in a hyper-competitive, razor-thin margin kind of area, or is it something that has a bit of a competitive edge and enjoys a pretty decent margin? You know, and then what kind of mood? What how much of the heavy lifting does the market have to do in the sense of, you know, do I need the PE to be at 100 in 5 years' time to do well, or can I do well even if the market's in a funk and the PE's 10?
Yeah.
You know, but at least I know what needs to happen, and as new information comes to light, I can say, all right, well, that revenue assumption was a bit too optimistic, or maybe I was a bit silly to think the margins could be that good, or geez, you know, the world has changed, and maybe assuming 10 times sales was not a sensible approach anymore, or you know, you've got a touchstone to refer back to, and as long as you've worked through it, having consideration for some of these core fundamental type things, you're ahead of a lot of people.
Yeah, nice, mate. Lovely. Steve asked about the rule of 110 minus your age for shares and cash. I was going to say exactly that. I hate this idea. Here's the thing. It's absolutely completely situational and personality. Yeah. So let me start backwards. When you get to 65, if you have invested for long enough and had a decent return for long enough, you probably need no cash at all. Which sounds stupid, right? But hear me out. Let's just make up a number. Let's say by the time you retire, you got $2 million in investable assets. And let's say it's today, right? So we're in inflation and time value money and stuff. Let's say you retired today at 65 with $2 million. If you get the average dividend return from the ASX, that's 4.5%. If you throw on top of that, the franking credits, average franking credits, let's call it 5.5 because it makes my maths easier, mate. That's 110 grand a year, essentially tax-free. You'll pay a little bit of tax on that, but with the franking credits, think about maybe let's call it 90 grand after tax, 85 grand after tax, just for fun. I haven't done the numbers. Let's assume it's that. And let's assume dividends fluctuate a little bit. Some years it's 95 grand, other years it's 75 grand or 70 grand. That is perfectly enough for anybody with a sensibly diversified portfolio to live a very, very, very happy life and not have any cash at all.
Mm.
Okay. Now that's pretty aggressive as a concept. General advice would be have 3 to 5 years of cash aside in case you have to pay bills and other things or your investments are suffering. But if you are literally, so we run a service called Everlasting Income. This is not a plug at all, but we own, it's 19 stocks and one cash position. The cash position is 4% of the portfolio. And that's just to allow for a buffer of dividends being received and cash coming out for living expenses, right? And we target 4% return. We're going to get more than that, which means we actually slowly build the portfolio, but 4% is conservative and reasonable, and it doesn't risk our members overspending. If you're able to do that and extract that sort of cash, unless your living expenses are much higher, and if they are, then probably have a good look at yourself. You don't need cash because, unless you're just simply trying to mentally, personally, emotionally deal with volatility. Because the shares could, think about again, the GFC, shares doubled and halved and whatever. That portfolio I talked about, I only use that because it's a worked example, kept paying out exactly that same amount every time, despite the fact that a lot of dividends were cut and suspended and then returned and whatever. We paid out 4% and 4% for every single month, well, 1/12 of that, 4% per annum, regardless. The shares crashed massively, then recovered well, and we just kept paying it out. So we didn't need any extra cash other than to buffer the flow of cash flows, dividend to the account. Other people, though, will freak out if it's a 40% decline, sell everything, and that's why it's personality related. But purely academically, intellectually, if you have enough of a portfolio that you can fund your lifestyle from the dividends, you don't need anything else. Now, I'm not saying, Stephen, what you should do, because I can't give you personal advice. I intend to retire, hopefully, if my investing does well enough, with a portfolio. That means I don't need any extra cash. Now, if I retired with 150 grand in cash and I was going to pull it down over the next 3 years and then go on the pension, then yeah, I should be in cash because I don't want to have to sell in the middle of a COVID crash or something else. So it depends entirely on how much money you bring. Now, you're 31, you've been investing since 26. But if you can keep earning and keep saving, most people in that situation would find themselves with more than enough money in their portfolio between that and super to not need to be conservative. The other thing is, if you're 65 and you're retiring, or 67 as you'll be, you've probably got 30 years of life left. That is way too early to start harming compounding. 30 more years of compounding over that period of time while you take some money out, I think well and truly worthwhile. So like Andrew, I hate it. Other than if you just need to just sleep at night, if you need to because you're, not you personally, but if anyone's not emotionally kind of experienced or kind of consistent enough to be able to go through those, in retirement, you can have more money in, right? If you're 75 and the market falls 40%, you're probably going to hate it. And if you're going to freak out at that point, you would have been better having some in cash. But generally speaking, for me, I intend to have a full portfolio generating dividend income, maybe even selling some that make good capital gains, depending on how it works, right through retirement. Ram?
Yeah, I think you've covered it well there. I just general rules of thumb, or people like to sort of quote these things almost as law, life doesn't fit into a nice little neat box like that. So
yep,
I've got a friend who's about my age, and he's just massively risk averse, and he earns a good wage, it's just all in cash, and I cannot get him to make any investments. He had some bad experiences with his family and losing money mm-hmm. in the past through some dodgy, you know, share market operation. You can't change his mind, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, you've got a long time left on this mortal coil. You were just losing, at the moment, you're losing 6 or 7% a year in purchasing power. I'm just saying, do something conservative. You know, I can throw anything I want at him from a logical, rational point of view, and he's not going to change his mind. So what's the right answer? It's actually, well, for him, that's the perfectly right answer. And the difference here is that he's not going in, his eyes are wide open. It's like, I know there is an opportunity cost for this. But for the way I look at the world, I'm more than happy to take that for the sleep at night factor. I was like, okay.
Yep.
I think you're crazy, but you know, if it works for you, it works for you.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Let's go to Mark, who says, hello, Scott and Andrew. I hope the weather is a lot nicer than here in southern Victoria. That was a while ago, but I can say, looking out the window, the weather is nice here. It's cold. 11 degrees here today, the maximum, mate, but I'm not going to complain. The sun's out. He says, I'm a 27-year-old and got into investing after listening and subscribing to your services. Thank you, mate. I have several holdings, which overall I am happy with and invest for the long term. My question, I've not had the years or decades of experience in watching the market grow. However, I've started to notice a trend in my research. Stocks that have been listed for over a decade seem to have had steady rises and gentle inclines, generally and holistically from my eyes, he says. I can't help but think, with the amount of accessible devices and trading platforms, there are easier ways to invest, which lures in younger and less informed investors. I feel a simple market-sensitive announcement now can cause bigger than ever fluctuations in prices. Throw in a war, pandemic, and inflation, and I appreciate there will be a bit of movement. However, I can't help but think we are in an incredibly bullish time in which fear, air quotes, finfluencers, and how to get rich quick schemes are wrecking a potentially steadier growth, which I alluded to earlier. To give you some insight, I'm holding stocks such as Kogan, I own those, Super Retail, Novonics, Fortescue Metals, I own those, and Nanosonics. I do have some solid stocks like Medibank Private and Vicinity Centres. I'd love to hear what you think about this. Am I simply looking at stocks that are susceptible to the smallest of market announcements? How can a young man place money confidently in a current market? Fool on. I've always wanted to say that, from Mark. Love it, Mark. Fool on. Ram, a lot of people investing in the market, the Wall Street Bets crowd, the Robinhood app traders, everyone's in there. The stocks are all over the joint. Is Mark right? Are we seeing more volatility in some of these companies than we used to?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't have the data. The data would tell us. Someone somewhere, some financial academic has crunched the numbers and will be able to tell you. But I do think that we often, as long as I can remember, people have said, well, the markets are different now. They used to be like this. And I think they've always been volatile and crazy. Maybe a little bit more. Maybe, I don't know. Let's play it through. Let's say that it has. Fantastic, I say. Bring it on.
But Mark's trying to have confidence in his investing thesis. I mean, yeah, but he's struggling to be confident because he's kind of seeing this whipsawing from the market. He's like, dude, I'm just trying to, like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to get it right. And I keep getting just bashed and bashed and bashed. And I'm kind of thinking, geez, do I really want to do this?
Yeah. Well, with the greatest of respect, Mark, you're looking at the wrong thing. You're looking at the volatility in the market, which is everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Virtually everyone. Oh, what am I doing? Oh, this is up, this is down. This is, it feels like it's moving even more than things used to. It's like, but you're losing sight of the forest for the trees.
Right.
Look at the business. What's the business done?
Yeah.
Nanosonics, out of all the stocks you mentioned, I've got a very small holding in Nanosonics in real life and none on Strawman anymore. But I know it incredibly well. Here's a business with a fortress balance sheet. They got more money than God sitting in their bank account, right? They've got this razor and blade model, which is super high net margin.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
You know, they got cash just gushing in, except they're spending some more on some. They're now taking over the direct sales operations. They're getting a higher margin because they've taken GE out as a reseller. Mm-hmm. They've got some new products in the works. They've got a huge market opportunity in North America to continue to capture more of the market. What is wrong with this picture? What is wrong with it? Like, you know, and yet it's one of the most shorted stocks on the ASX at the moment. What's going on? You know, now to square the circle, I've just sort of said I've sold down, and I actually had them for years and years. It was purely an opportunity cost consideration. I feel as though shares are on slightly on the expensive side of things. Having said that, if you know, some really high quality companies deserve to be a bit more expensive. I'm right or wrong, I just had other opportunities elsewhere. I needed to free up some capital. I freed up some capital from something I thought was a little bit overvalued to something I thought was considerably undervalued. So don't read too much into it. But of all of that analysis, my decision hasn't been based on what the share price has done. My decision was entirely based on what the business has done. How does that compare with what is available right now, in terms of what I can sell it for versus what I can do elsewhere with it? So whether it happens to be people will use this term beta, like how volatile it is relative to the average. Maybe it's got a really high beta. You know, so when the market goes up 1%, it goes up 2%. When the market falls 3%, it falls 6%. You know, really high beta kind of stock. Great. Who cares? That's not coming into my calculus. The calculus I could press a button and put the money somewhere else. Is there a bit of better risk reward opportunity?
Yeah.
That's the calculus. In terms of what matters, I've just sort of scraped the surface there, but understanding the business, its prospects, its balance sheet, all of those things, they're the things to watch. Forget about all this other stuff. It's just noise.
Yeah, So I'm just going to add to that, mate, only because your points are spot on, Mark. I actually think Mark's right, mate. I think I've said on the podcast, I've certainly commented to the team, I may have even said to you either on podcast or not, I do think the sudden and instantaneous falls particularly, but some of the rises, are bigger than we would have seen in the past. It does seem like the whipsawing on announcements when companies are slightly disappointing. I think there are more 30, 25, 30, 35% falls than we used to have 5 or 7 years ago. I could be completely wrong. It could be rose-colored glasses.
Maybe.
I feel like the responses are getting more significant because of the combination of, I don't think it's just, by the way, young people and traders, but computerized algorithms and stuff like that. They're falling, so let's get out. When they get out, it makes it fall further. That triggers more people to get out. These things can be, to some degree, self-fulfilling prophecies.
I'm a small cap investor, mate. That's just a Tuesday.
But I do think, some of the bigger companies, I think it's unusual. It was unusual. I think it's more common the last 3 or 4 earnings periods, the last 2 or 3 years, than it was previously. That's certainly been the sense. I could be absolutely just anchoring. So, and all rose-colored glasses ing. So for what it's worth, take that. Mm-hmm. That being said, Mark, I want to reiterate Andrew's point because the market is not there to serve you. And
it's not there to inform you.
Sorry, it's not there to inform you. Thank you. You're right, actually. I meant serve as in look after you as opposed to be available for you. But yes, you're right. Market's not there to inform you. But it's also the other investors aren't there to make you feel better is what I meant by serve, right? They're not there to help you feel good about your investments. The fact that big old companies go up and down more slowly is probably right because they are more stable businesses. You know, for all of the investment merits or otherwise of CSL and Commonwealth Bank and News Corp and Telstra, they're not going to be very surprising. None of them are going to do anything meaningful that's going to shock the socks off you, right? Versus a company that is smaller, that is less formidable, Nanosonics notwithstanding, that has people more concerned about what might happen next. If you're, say, for example, in discretionary retail like you've identified, or Fortescue Metals Group that I own, that is susceptible to the iron ore price. Those things are going to move like that because they simply have those moving parts. And we've talked a lot already this episode and on Friday about the long-term realities of this sort of stuff. I absolutely think you're right. Andrew doesn't, and he may well be right. I think you're right, we're seeing more volatility. But it's really, really important that you don't, as Andrew says, succumb to that volatility as a reason to invest or not to invest. What you're looking for is certainty and confirmation, and I don't blame you because everybody is and everyone would love that. You need to make your peace with the fact it's not going to come. And even if it does, think about, again, the Zip investor. When the shares went from $5 to $14 and told everyone, look how right I am. I've made a fortune. Look at my shares going up. I'm a genius. See, look, they're going up. And they fall from 14 to 40 cents. And you go, oh, I see. Which was right? Well, neither or both, but it's not the point. The point is, as Andrew says, whether the business is worth what you paid for it. If Novonix is a bigger, better, more profitable business in 10 years' time, you'll be glad you bought it today. If Super Retail Group continues, I think it's a really high quality retailer, by the way. But yeah, it moves around because people jump in and out. They are responding to the news. The only question you've got to ask yourself is this going to be a better, bigger business in 5 and 10 years' time? If the answer is yes, ignore the volatility as much as it hurts, as hard as it is. We've just talked about that a lot in this podcast and Friday's podcast. That's what you need to do. So is it the fault of day traders, of apps? Maybe, even if it is true. Andrew doesn't think it is. I think it possibly is, but either way, does it matter? No, it's just the reality, right? If it had always been like that, let's just for the fun of it, go back 40 years and say markets have been this volatile for the last 40 years. They still would have got to exactly where they got to because the underlying businesses did exactly what they did and the share prices are exactly what they are. Whether they fluctuated the entire time or whether it's slow, steady upward trend from 1982 to today, the same result is the end. Whether it fluctuates in the meantime, you've used the example, Andrew, I love, of the, you know, watching a bloke take a dog for a walk, right? The dog's all over the place. The guy still gets to the same point. That you know,
everyone's watching the dog. Everyone is watching the dog and trying to guess where he's going to go next. And everyone else knows, well, just wherever the man walking the dog is going to go, right, That's where the dog is going to go, whether he likes it or not.
And it doesn't matter which of those things is true, right? Because the starting point is the starting point, the end point is the end point. Even if you watch the dog, you watch the dog for the long term, the dog still gets the same point as the bloke. You know, so it doesn't actually matter which one you watch. You shouldn't watch the dog because it's a waste of time. But what I'm saying is the experience you're having, Mark, of the dog you're watching is understandable, and I absolutely understand and empathize with the concern. You've just got to either make your peace with it or ignore it. I'd say ignore it personally, but maybe making your peace is actually better because it means you can not be influenced by it if you do happen to see it or notice it or get told about it. But staying the course is the key one.
I'm going to flip it around, mate. Don't even make your peace with it or ignore it. Okay. Relish it. Really should.
No.
If you think of, I mean, this it sounds trite again, but
it's hard. If
you,
it is,
I know, and it's just so easy to say.
Differently wired than most people.
Look, but I mean, if you think about it intellectually for a second, so yeah, to use your example from 1980 through to today,
yep.
What would you want? Would you want something that was really volatile or not? Now, yeah. the advantage of being really volatile is that these swings, you're going to swing, like in a perfectly efficient market, it's just going to perfectly track intrinsic value and you're always going to get a pretty average return by definition. What you want is a market where periodically it just swings to ridiculously undervalued status. Thank you. So you're telling me that I've got a choice between something where it's like there's no sales, or I can go to the shop and every now and again something's 40% off.
Exactly.
I'll take that. Now, if Mark was 67, I'd go, okay, that's a different scenario. Yeah. Yep. He's 31, did you say?
Yes.
You know, that great.
No, I think he was younger than that, actually. I think
27.
Mark, 27. Yep.
Oh, my God. Wow. You know, long, exactly. Long may it persist, yeah, Mark. Long yeah, may you yeah. see. Wouldn't it be great for you? Now, let's assume that you just stick with Nanosonics. Let's say that you think it's the shares are, gosh, I don't even know what they are at the moment. Let me just quickly bring that up. Let's say, so shares at the moment are 460 odd. Let's say you think these are a $15 share in 10 years' time, for the sake of argument.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be great? Now, A, would you be happy to hold them now at 460, knowing it's going to be $15 at that point? Yes, you would. But wouldn't it be even better for someone who's working and saving money if between then and now they got to a dollar and then stayed there for 5 years? Like, logically.
Yeah. Yeah, correct.
That would be fantastic because now I'm actually able to buy in at even cheaper and cheaper prices. So long as that destination, your view of that destination is reasonably accurate, you should beg and plead for big, irrational plunges in price.
Mm. Yeah, no, fair enough, mate. That's fair. I think the challenge is embrace it if you can, if your personality lets you. If not, then try and put it out of your mind. But either or both, trying to get caught in the middle might be the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. And I just very quick clarification. Mm. Sometimes that goes awry when if your calculus is entirely wrong. Mm. Nanosonics is going to be 20 cents in 15 years' time. Then holding it now doesn't make sense, and backing the truck up when it gets to a dollar doesn't make any sense as well. So everything I've said only makes sense if you've still got that confidence in that long term value.
Fair enough too. From James, mate. Hello, Scott and Rampage. Scott, I hope you enjoyed your trip. I did. Thank you, James. I enjoyed it immensely. I've only recently started investing, and it's all thanks to you two. Oh, dear. At a younger age, I got suckered into the Get Rich Quick day trading course. Fool me once, he says. Since this experience and my general lack of knowledge of the share market, I had avoided it. Since stumbling across the podcast, I have learnt much, so thank you. I'm only 35, so I have good many years of investing ahead of me. I'm currently just focusing on a few ETFs with regular investment. However, I'm researching a few companies that I'm interested in. My questions are completely unrelated. However, here they are. Number one, why is Andrew called Ram?
That was a nickname that, was it you or was it?
It was me. Yeah, completely my fault.
Because I am fond of a good rant. And there was a lot of Rampage there, and my surname is Page, and so Rampage, and that's...
Yeah.
So
it, just the old good old Aussie nickname. Just, what do you call someone with the surname of Page? And we went with Ram, and it sort of stuck. And can I tell you too, mate, how long since you left the Motley Fool?
5 years or something?
I had someone mention you yesterday and ask about, how's Ram going? I thought it was brilliant. So even people who haven't worked with you for years and don't talk to you regularly are still referring to you as Ram, which I just warms the cockles of my heart.
Yeah, I love it.
James, the second question, mate, is what resources and how have you or will you go about educating your kids on finance, the stock market, and the philosophy of long-term investment? I came from an old school family that never discussed finances and as a result grew up with very little financial education. I don't want my kids to end up in the same situation. I was explaining to my 8-year-old how shares work at a rudimentary level. On conclusion of our conversation, he decided he isn't going to own a public company because he doesn't want to share.
Love it.
Mate, can I tell you, James, if you do a good enough job that he can buy a public company outright and make it a private company, good luck to him. Otherwise, he may just have to share. But that is so great. I love the idea of just want to share. That's fantastic. My young bloke's 9, so I'm feeling some of your pain. It's a really good question, Ram. Can I tell you, we've done this for years. I have two young blokes. One's 26, one's 9. So very different age groups and very different experiences. And I've got to say, mate, I've been thinking this through for a long time. My oldest is my wife's son, but the youngest is ours. And I've had plenty of time to think about this. I still don't have an answer. It's one of my great failures as a stepfather and a father is. I don't have a really good answer. And frankly, given I do this for a job, it's pretty negligent on me not have that answer. But I think the problem is you learn to be a parent at the same time as you try and learn finance and try and work out what's age appropriate, what works and what doesn't, and how do you land it all. I don't have an answer. I hope you do, because I can't help, James, at least with anything really, really concrete.
I think one of the many frustrating things of kids is that you can have the best thing. They're not going to be interested at the time that you're ready to teach, unfortunately. Yeah. So I've had it, my eldest is 12 going on 13, so he's coming into the teenage years. And, you know, whenever I start to, his eyes just roll over. He's just so sick. Yeah, whatever, Dad. Whatever. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and it is, the kids just, they've got a different outlook. They live in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very hard for me to sort of say, oh, don't have this marshmallow now and you'll get two marshmallows in a year's time. A year? I mean, that's like saying to an adult in the year 2289.
Yes, so true, mate.
You know, like they're just not going to get it. So it's, I also don't have an answer.
It's hard enough for 25-year-olds, quite honestly, mate. Even those who know that they know that they know, being 25 and thinking about retiring is just such a bloody foreign concept. Then imagine trying to do an 8-year-old. It's not even a criticism. It's just, again, we talk about evolution, right? We're just not made to think 40, 60 years in advance, particularly when we're kids, but even when we're adults.
Yeah.
Trying to get, you know, the amount of people who took money out of super because I'm 25, I've got plenty of years to save and I want the jet ski or the TV now.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just really, really hard.
What I've offered my kids is I'll say, I give them a ridiculously high rate of interest. And I do that because, you know, they've got $5 or something.
You wait till you get some money from grandma and they've got $5,000.
That's right. Then I'm going to be in trouble. But I will say, you know, it's just sort of like,
Reserve Bank of Andrew will reduce interest rates because of economic instability or something.
Yeah, that's right. Doing a bit of quantitative easing on the kids. But I will actually absolutely say to him, it's just like, I'll give you 20% monthly interest. Give me this. You've got, somehow he's done a bit of work. You've got $10 in his pocket. Give it to me. Nice. And at the end of the month, I'll give you $12. That's a 20% rate of interest in a month. I mean, annualize that. It's insane. Warren Buffett would be knocking the door down to get that, you know. But then he goes, so I get $12 in 4 weeks' time. Yes.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that's good. Yes.
That's the problem.
But I've got $10 now. Yes.
Yep.
Or I could, not interested.
I go and buy that toy that I want because I want the toy right now.
Yeah.
And I haven't got the facilities to actually delay gratification because I'm 8.
It's really, really tricky. But I've just been consistent with it. It's just like, whenever you want it, it is here. Yeah. And then there has been, despite despite the inclination for us in him, we shoot themselves in the foot. He has taken me up on it before.
Okay.
And you know, it's sort of like that moment when he goes, because he'll be in that right frame of mind, going, yeah, okay, I don't really want it right now. And then I set something on my phone and then actually give him a little bit extra, right? So there you go, it's $15 just to use the same example before. And it's like, whoa, that feels really good. I just reminds like, you know, you could have spent this on that stupid plastic thing that you wanted. Here's $15. now buy a slightly more expensive piece of crap plastic thing. But it is that I think you do see a bit of a light bulb moment go off. So my plan is just to try and reiterate that again and again and again. But the other thing that every parent makes heaps of mistakes, and I'm sure we're making tons of it. But I also think the best thing you can do as a parent is just be a good role model and be the kind of person who isn't frivolous with their spending, because kids, monkey see, monkey do, right?
Yep.
So I think if you can sort of show a bit of restraint and stuff, it probably rubs off unintentionally. But I don't know. I've got no easy answers.
Yep. No, I love it, mate. I think that's all really good advice. A couple of things for me is I think I love the monkey see, monkey do, just straight out. This is what we do. And just trying to kind of develop some of those behaviors. And that will absolutely work. It won't work all the time. It won't work the way you want, but it will work. I've given the example before of my 26-year-old when he was 14, 15. He wanted to buy a $3,000 computer because he had the money. And I was like, oh, dude. Maybe he's a bit older. I was like, oh, dude. I mean, I hear what you're saying. And we sat and had a really good conversation about it. He came back and said, Scott, I hear what you say and I appreciate it. I really value what you said, but I'm going to buy the computer anyway. It's like, cool, that's fine. You know, and that has to be okay because the kids need to make their own decisions and be empowered to do that. And I will say even now he says, financially it's probably wasn't the greatest idea, but I really loved that computer at the time. I'm like, well, you know what? That's kind of, it needs to be okay. Plenty of people, by the way, will grow up not suitable for it. I love the hell out of superannuation. If it's not the best thing financially we've had in the last 40 years, I don't know what is, because it saves us from our monkey selves. And that's just, so, you know, some people just need to rely on that and that's okay too. For us with our young bloke, the idea of interest of getting money for nothing. So your point about the, you know, $12, $10, that's not a lot of money, but it's like, how about I give you $2 in you know, in a month's time? If you just leave the money here. The idea of getting something for nothing is important. We've talked about dividends with our young bloke. Just the idea of, you know, and we used our example. We haven't told him the amount of money we have or invest or how much we get. But occasionally I'll say, oh, look, mate, I got a couple hundred bucks from whatever it was company in the bank account the other day. What for? Nothing. I just own the shares. So you got money for nothing. Yeah, literally money. Wow, money for nothing. That sounds awesome. So that's super useful. So that works for us. And then just owning, being an owner of a company, talking about the businesses that we own is just kind of impressive for kids. And that can start something. So we own some shares in X. We own some shares in Telstra. We own some shares in Coke. I've already mentioned this episode. I'll mention it again and we'll have a drink. And you know, it just Amazon again, same. Just because it's a thing, right? And it creates that idea of, as you say, the old school kind of not talking about finances. We're trying to reverse that and say, you know, we're not going to give you the dollars and cents because kids can't handle that information. They'll tell their mates or they won't, or they'll, you know, if you've got a spare $5, the kids assume you can spend it on them because that's just, you know, Dad, have you got $100? I want this thing. Either you've got $100, you can't have it. Okay, that's one. Or just, man, no, I don't have the money. Don't have $100, you know. He thinks I've got $1,000, which is lovely right now. And that suits me down to the ground. But at some point, he'll realize that we have a couple more dollars more than that. So that's part of it. So that's what I think, just tell him about what you own, the fact you're only buying some shares, talk about it around the dinner table, make it part of that conversation. It's probably as useful as it's going to get. Last thing from me, I've talked about my nephews before. They are two really same parents, same experiences. That one's only 18 months older than the other one. But so incredibly different. One is a massive saver. He's never going to work ever because he's going to save so much money. He's going to earn less money and compound his money, and therefore he doesn't have to work. He's going to be a millionaire, so who cares? That's actually become counterproductive because now he's starting to talk about, doesn't matter what I do for a job. I'm going to have all this money. I'm going to be rich. I don't need to work. It's like, oh, it doesn't quite work that way. But he's saving like bugger and he's investing and he's just loving it. The other kid just wants to spend and spend and spend. And he can, you know, he never found something he couldn't spend money on. He couldn't justify buying computers or musical instruments or whatever he wants to do, right? And that's the same kid, the same biology, the same life experience, the same family, the whole lot. So it is. It does come down, unfortunately, sometimes just to biology and celebrate the kids for who they are. But that's what I would suggest personally.
You got me thinking with the super thing. I think every time I give my kids some money for doing a job, you know, they wash the car or something, I'll say, I'll pay you whatever. Let's stick with round numbers, $10 for that.
Yeah.
I should give them $9 and keep them $1.
Put a dollar in super.
And I should have a ledger or something somewhere on my phone so at least I can show them. They'll be That's happy. Cool, here's your money.
And that's then quite cool.
Yeah, maybe that works. Maybe
yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Hey, don't be cheap though. Give him 10 and then take a dollar on top of that and put it aside.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I like it. James's last question. I've looked at the list of ASX listed companies and was amazed how many public companies have listed over the last 3 years.
Yeah,
I assume there's a relatively low success rate, and some quick research indicated about a 6% success rate. Given this, what is the attraction of IPOs? Is it just a hope and a pray that it is successful and therefore produces significant returns? Is it worth the risk over a period of time? Mm. Regards, James.
Great question. So, well, actually, a broader answer first. When you look at the share market, we often talk about the average share market return. That is delivered pretty much thanks to, I think, like something like less than 10% of the stocks on the market.
Yeah.
So you have these, what you generally have when you're looking at averages, you have this handful of just absolute killer stocks and a big, big chunk of mediocrity and then a long tail of absolute disasters. That's the public markets, which is why ETFs are so sort of compelling, because you just sort of guarantee that you capture the big ones. So you don't get the stock that 1,000x's over 10 years, but directly, you get exposure to it, and that more than offsets all the losses. So there's something to be said for that. But it does. The reason I mention that is because part of that is a lot of companies at least just don't do well. Mm. And really, if I wanted to be a cynic, I would say the whole point of a public market is exit liquidity for insiders. I've got my business.
Yeah.
I'm a bit sick of it now. I want to, I've spent like the better part of 20 years building it, and now I just want out. Well, how do I sell it? I've list on the market. I sell my shares. See you later. Mm. That's the cynic's kind of view of it. The other part of it is that it's this annoying answer of it depends. I mean, I can think of some IPOs that were just incredible opportunities, you know, and then I can think of a bunch that aren't. Right. I haven't done the hard core analysis to work out what it is. So it depends. The risk of a IPO is that you don't have years and years of publicly disclosed financial information to help inform your decision. Yes, in the prospectus they'll provide you with that, but if I know I'm going to list my business, my target is to sort of list in the next couple of years, I'm going to run things very differently to dress up my financials. I'm not lying about them, but I'm probably going to cut back on any sort of growth expenditure. I'm probably going to be a little bit tighter with some of my costs. I'm going to try and bring as many sales forward as I can. You know, you're going to. And then the investment bank that is paid very well, mind you, to bring you to market is a salesperson. That's what they're doing. Their job is to sell your company. And there has never been a prospectus in the history of the world that goes, well, it's okay, but there's a few things you need to be aware of. No, every prospectus is glowing. And again, nothing you would hope, and for the most part it's true, that there's no outright lies or fraud within that. But they are going to, you know, the real estate agent that's selling a house is not going to go out of their way to point out some, you know, a bit of some white ant problems in a corner of one room. Like you're just not going to do it unless what is absolutely legally required. So I personally am in no rush to get into an IPO. There have been exceptions in the past where I just thought it was really attractive. But generally speaking, what's the rush? What's the rush? And if you look at a lot of those ones that have listed in recent years, you'll actually look at it right now and say, now is that you've actually got a chance to buy the same company at a much cheaper price because of the way things have gone, and with a bit more water under the bridge in terms of the financials that have been released. There is very little reason in investing that you need to act right now. You know, you've usually got time on your side.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't have much more than that. The answer is greed, as always. I mean, greed is a bad thing. It's a deadly sin, all that kind of stuff. Everyone investing is investing for more in the future. So we're all tapping into the same idea in different ways, shapes, or forms. But James, it's unbridled greed. The story of the 1 cent IPO that went to $15 is what everyone else wants to jump on just in case they possibly maybe get that. And there was a really long string. Going back to pre-GFC, I probably am, of these, you know, stag profits, as they call them, the one-day jumps of 40, 50, 60, 70, 80% on IPOs. And everyone wanted to be in on that so they could get their money and make their quick buck. And obviously it's, you know, not obviously. It was also offered to insiders who then made out like bandits. It's a messy, messy, messy area. I generally, as a rule, I don't think I've ever bought a company that's been listed for less than a year. I could be wrong, and I should put an asterisk on that and say I haven't checked recently. They'll make sure that I'm right. For Andrew's reason, there's just no need to. There's no reason to do it. There are some companies I'd love to own, and maybe if one of those came public, I might even try and buy the IPO or something, you know, depending on the price, because some great private businesses out there. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is every company in the ASX was an IPO at one point. So also remember that the businesses that we know and love today were originally private companies that came public. That's you can't go on the ASX without having a public offering. That's exactly what it does to get listed. And so think about the top 20, 40, 50, 80, 100 companies that have been around forever. They listed at some point and have made a lot of money for a lot of people. CSL, Commonwealth Bank, BHP, Telstra, maybe not Telstra, actually, Woolies, Wesfarmers, Coles, even Soul Patts, which listed back in 1900 and something, right? I own shares in Soul Patts. Was an IPO at some point. And so, you know, not all IPOs are going to go badly, but yeah, absolutely, you're right. It's a messy area. A lot of those that IPO are just doing it because they want cash, as Andrew says. They're either speculative businesses who are trying to, you know, maybe they're biotech or they're miners who just want to tap the public markets to get money to try and discover the next big thing. And if they do, Fortescue is a great example. It's gone spectacular, just so well. And good on Twiggy. He's built a great business and done a lot of good stuff, and he's made a fortune for a lot of people. But for every Fortescue, there's, you know, dozens and dozens of others that haven't. The odds aren't particularly great, unfortunately. So as Andrew says, getting exposure to that anyway is a good idea. But I would always wait a year. I want to see two full... I would even wait almost 18 months. I would want not only a full year of financials, but I want to see the first year of like-for-like versus the last time it reported as a public company.
Yeah.
So let's say it reports this August for the first time. I want to see that in February. Then I get a full year's worth of data. I'd probably even wait till next August's numbers so I could get the first year-on-year comparison, just see how the business is continuing to perform. No guarantees even by that, but a pretty good start. Some will double in that period of time, mate. I will miss a double. I'll be like, oh, bugger. Others will fall 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. I'll go, oh, good, lucky you missed that. There's no way to know in advance, but don't worry about missing a little bit. Don't. You know, it's, as Andrew says, there's no hurry, right? If you're right, you're right. If you're wrong, you're wrong. Don't feel the need to get rushed into buying something.
Can I give you a hack? Please. So obviously read the prospectus, right? Read all the glossy brochure material as to what the company's going to do and all the forecasts. Yep. Great.
Yeah.
Pay especially close attention to what the current owners are doing. How much are they selling down? How much options contracts do they get? How long are the shares that they remain are in escrow for?
Yep.
There are absolutely examples. I was very cynical before, but there's absolutely examples of companies that are just like crushing it. And they're going to the public market because they want to tap more money because they've just invented something brilliant and they want to look at Facebook.
Imagine, and they should.
I remember Google. At the time Facebook listed its IPO was on like 100 times earnings and I thought, this is stupid. Yeah. Do you remember that? Those going back a while.
I think I wrote an article about it, but I tried to find it the other day. A year or so ago, I couldn't find it. So I'm hopeful I either didn't do it or it's been lost in history because I was stupid stock. Don't buy Facebook.
We shouldn't be reminding, you know. And it turns out that, you know, even despite what's happened, it was actually a really good move. Zuck kept a bunch of shares, you know. But look at what the insiders are doing. I don't want to name names because I don't want to get myself into legal trouble. But there's a company that listed recently, and the insiders were just basically dumping all of their shares. They had all these low hurdles where they got all of these shares that would come into the money at very very short time frames at very attractive rates, and then they were allowed to sell very quickly. Now, these things don't happen by accident. You're not structuring things in this way if you're genuinely looking to participate in the long-term wealth creation of the business. You are structuring this thing so you can get the hell out as quickly as possible. Get a little bit of a salary along the way, probably a very good salary along the way, and slowly dump your shares on market. And then by the time everyone else realizes that this whole thing is a nightmare, you're already sold out at much higher prices to other people. It's horrible, but it happens. So look at that part very closely.
Be careful. Yep, be careful. Again, there's always exceptions to the other thing, right? But the exception proves the rule. It doesn't mean the rule is invalid, so just be careful. Yeah. Let's go with the last one for Scott. We've gone a little bit over time, mate. We've got a massive amount of mail, so let's try and get through one quick one more. Anyway, what I was going to say. Hi, Scott and Ram, says Scott. Excuse me. Thanks for all your hard work. A question for the pod. My approach to investing is fairly simple and very much long-term. That is two very good things to be, simple and long-term. Every week I contribute into an index fund. I've done this since the COVID crash and plan to keep doing this forever. Scott, I think there are very, very, many, many, many fewer things that are sure bets than that. I think it's a really, really smart idea. Occasionally, when I do have a few more dollars to play with, thanks to a tax return or a bonus, I will use that money to invest in individual stocks. My first question is this. Is there anything wrong with this approach? I realize I'm jumping from dollar cost average and an index fund on one hand to shifting gears and buying individual stocks on another. Anything wrong with that idea, Ram?
No, nothing at all.
Yep. I agree.
Yeah.
don't feel like you need, we said this a little bit earlier, don't feel like you need to artificially constrain your investing or be somehow holier than thou or stricter in your application. As long as well as rather than instead of, I think that's a super smart thing to do. Think about, I don't know what the size of the relative investments are. That'd be the only question I'd ask. If you're going to kind of, you know, if you're putting in, I don't know, $500 a month and then you get a 10 grand bonus, well, that's going to dwarf the $500 a month. So maybe just be careful about how you're allocating that, what it does to the sort of the size and the balance of your portfolio. If you're buying one stock with 10 grand and then you're buying an ETF with $500 a month, you'll end up with a few stocks that are bigger than that. And if you haven't maybe been thoughtful about what they are or you're not experienced what they are, they might bring you undone. So just be a little bit careful with that. But other than that, I see no problem at all. A second related question, if I may, he says, I'm long-term focused. So I see bear markets like this one as a buying opportunity. He says in brackets, there's a joke in there somewhere about Yogi Bear and the picnic basket. There's got to be one somewhere. We'll work on that one. I instinctively look at buying individual stocks rather than buying more of the index fund I'm invested in. My question is, does the calculus change at all in a bear market? That is the decision-making process of choosing between individual stocks versus the index fund any different when we're in a bear market? Interested in your thoughts, he says in brackets, please feel free to rant away. It's always entertaining for us listeners. Cheers, Scott. We'll try not to, Scott, because we've gone long on this episode, but it's a good question, mate. Should there be more or less interest in individual stocks versus ETFs when we're in different types of markets?
I'm tempted to say my instinctual answer is no, not really. We were talking before about the importance of process and just being consistent and, you know, good times and bad. There is a part of me, though, that would imagine that when we do get into a bear market, and that's defined as the overall general market as measured by an index sort of falling by 20% or so more, within that average, there's all kinds of variations from the mean. I look at the market at the moment. So the all odds is down 10% or so from last year's high. It's hardly anything, you know.
Yeah.
But there are stocks in there that have fallen 40%. So when I look at, again, everything needs to be looked through the lens of opportunity cost. So I've got a bit of extra money in my pocket. I can buy an index into the index again, which is down about 10%. And that'll probably be a very sensible decision over time. It's a very safe, easy decision. But then within that, there's maybe the company I'm looking at's actually done incredibly well. And it happens to be more volatile, been an area of the market that's a little bit scary at the moment. And that is going to give me a far better risk reward opportunity. If I can buy into that without drastically altering the overall structure of my portfolio, I'd be tempted to go that way. In fact, that tends to be exactly what I do.
I don't think it changes. I don't personally think it changes. It matters what part of the market you're in, because the reality is individual stocks have not every single stock. The vast bulk of stocks have a larger range of outcomes than the average index, almost by definition, right? If you're Telstra, maybe not. If you're a pipeline or a toll road, again, COVID notwithstanding, probably not, because the cash flows are reasonably known, and the things that impact the total market, for example, might be iron ore prices or retail sales that may not impact you if you're a gas pipeline or a, I don't know what else, you know, an airport or something. So I think it's, but broadly, I'm going to make numbers, Andrew. I reckon 92.34693% of companies have a bigger range of outcomes than the market as a whole, which means that there is almost always more opportunity to beat the market or to lose to the market at any part of the in any part of the cycle, because that's just the reality, right? Excuse me. A stock might go up 30% or down 30%. in a day or a week or a month. The market's almost never going to do that, with the exception of COVID. So I don't think there's any point in time at which it's a better or worse idea to go index versus stocks in a relative sense. You might always say it's better to go stocks or always better to go indices, but I don't think it matters market-wise, because the decision you're making is probably comes down to your level of confidence, your conviction, your ability, your desire to take on more risk and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it should matter as much. That being said, it's possible that because of that, in a bear market, you have stocks that are down more than the market. And some will deserve it, but some won't. And so there's probably more opportunity, I would speculate, this is random out there speculation, if the market's down 15% and some companies down 30, 40, 50%, some are deserved to be, by the way. So again, it's really important you don't just say anything that's down more than the market is worth buying. That's not what I'm saying at all. Let me be really, really clear. But I think there is an opportunity to kind of go, okay, well, company X is down 50%. It doesn't deserve to be. The market's overreacting. Therefore, there's more upside when the market and this stock recovers than there is on the total market. I think that's also true. But just know you're taking more risk as well, because some don't recover the way you think they might, right? I'm going to buy HIH Insurance because when it recovers, it's an old name. And the old listeners will remember this one. When the market recovers, it'll be great. It subsequently goes broke, right? Or Enron. Or AMP is a great example, right? AMP is down this percent. It's got more upside recovery. When it goes up, gee, it's going to go up so much, and then it doesn't. Or Zip, $14 to $7. It's already fallen in half. Imagine when it goes back up, goes to $3. But imagine when it goes back up, goes to $1. Imagine when it goes back up. These things can happen and will happen from time to time. By the same token, give me an example, mate, of one that's crashed and then recovered strongly. Afterpay itself, actually, as much as I don't like it, it fell from, I'm going to say, 40 to 8 during the COVID, then went up to 100 or something. You know, those kind of stories, if you'd liked the story, if you believed in it, if you thought it was worthwhile, and again, it's probably a bad example because I didn't particularly like it. I don't particularly like it still. But, that's a situation where it fell probably 80%, the market fell 40%, and the recovery of the market was up 70%, and Afterpay went up, 1,000% or something. In those kind of circumstances, that's an illustration of where good stock picking during a crash, when they've been bombed out, and if they have that chance to recover and likelihood to recover, can do even better for you. Is that clear? Have I confused people?
I wish we worked in an industry where it was just easy answers. If
physicists or biologists or something, yeah. E always equals MC squared, because it just does, and here's the proof. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah, if I shoot a cannonball at this speed on that angle, it will land there. I wish it was. But although at the same time, I don't, because it is the nuance that gives the exactly. opportunity for the edge. And
if everything was perfectly priced, mate, then you and I would be looking for another job.
Oh, yeah. We'd basically be dealing with bonds. Yeah.
Yep. Scott, my bottom line is, I don't think I would rush out to change my investment approach to try and effectively time the market. If you're an ETF investor, excuse me, I would be inclined, I can't give you personal advice, mate, but if I was an ETF investor, I'd be inclined to keep ETF investing. Because the other thing is, probabilities work out over periods of time. If you have a bear market once every 5 years and you buy 3 stocks every time you do it, then in 10 years' time, you'll have bought 9 stocks total. The chance that your probability works out across that small number of instances is actually a really long. Whereas if you dollar cost average every month for 10 years, it's 120 different circumstances you're going to buy something. The odds are going to work out more like they should. You talked about 21 before, Andrew, and card games. Mm-hmm. I just would be a little bit careful about trying to selectively do that by one company at one point in the cycle. Maybe you get AMP, maybe you get Afterpay. Does that make either outcome invalid? No, but the money you end up with, that you may not get what you want. So just be a little bit careful. I don't know that I would pick an approach to your point before about trusting the process. Andrew, pick a process and just follow that through. And probably if the urge of being a bit greedy and then maybe getting pushed off your process because circumstances change, this time I'm going to make a fortune because I'm going to do this instead. Maybe you get lucky. Maybe you're even clever enough to do it, or maybe you kind of go, you know what? I got the greed pulled me off my long term strategy, and that went badly. Wouldn't be a completely foreign concept to many people. Are we done?
I think so.
Thank you for spending a bit more time with me today, mate. And thank you, listeners, for spending some more time with us. We've got a big mailbag to get through. Hopefully the questions were useful. They certainly were. Hopefully our answers were useful is maybe what I should have said. Questions were good. Answers, you can judge.
Well, we would have got through a lot more questions if we didn't ramble for so long either. Let's just put that out there.
Mate, just quietly. If anyone's listening to this podcast more than 3 weeks, they well and truly know that. But hopefully it was useful. Hopefully we've entertained you. Hopefully we've given you something to think about. Hopefully we've informed you as well. That's what we're trying to do. Most importantly, we hope you're enjoying the podcast. We hope it's worth spending about an hour with us in between your ears. If you have enjoyed it, please let us know. Please leave a review on iTunes if you would. Please tell your friends too. If you've got friends who you think might be interested, they may not love us, but they're not going to hate you for recommending it. So maybe drop them an idea. You know the socials. Quickly, if you want to send an email, info@fool.com.au. Follow either of us on Twitter @Sage_Simeon or @StrawmanInvest. Or follow me @TMFScottP or @TheMotleyFoolAU. Until next time, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.